The marriage of Quasimodo. We have just said that Quasimodo disappeared from Notre Dame on the day of the gypsies, and of the archdeacon's death. He was not seen again, in fact. No one knew what had become of him. During the night which followed the execution of La Esmeralda, the nightmen had detached her body from the gibbet, and had carried it, according to custom, to the cellar of Montfaucon. Montfaucon was, as Savile says, the most ancient and the most superb gibbet in the kingdom. Between the faubourgs of the Temple and St. Martin, about 160 toises from the walls of Paris, a few bow shots from Le Curtil, there was to be seen on the crest of a gentle, almost imperceptible eminence, but sufficiently elevated to be seen for several leagues round about, an edifice of strange form, bearing considerable resemblance to a Celtic cromlech, and where also human sacrifices were offered. Let the reader picture to himself, crowning a limestone hillock, an oblong mass of masonry 15 feet in height, 30 wide, 40 long, with a gate, an external railing and a platform. On this platform 16 enormous pillars of rough-hewn stone, 30 feet in height, arranged in a colonnade round three of the four sides of the mass which support them, bound together at their summits by heavy beams, whence hung chains at intervals. On all these chains, skeletons. In the vicinity, on the plain, a stone cross and two gibbets of secondary importance, which seemed to have sprung up as shoots around the central gallows. Above all this, in the sky, a perpetual flock of crows. That was Montfaucon. At the end of the 15th century, the formidable gibbet which dated from 1328, was already very much dilapidated. The beams were worm-eaten, the chains rusted, the pillars green with mold. The layers of hewn stone were all cracked at their joints, and grass was growing on that platform which no feet touched. The monument made a horrible profile against the sky, especially at night when there was a little moonlight on those white skulls, or when the breeze of evening brushed the chains and the skeletons, and swayed all these in the darkness. The presence of this gibbet sufficed to render gloomy all the surrounding places. The mass of masonry which served as foundation to the odious edifice was hollow. A huge cellar had been constructed there, closed by an old iron grating, which was out of order, into which were cast, not only the human remains, which were taken from the chains of Montfaucon, but also the bodies of all the unfortunates executed on the other permanent gibbets of Paris. To that deep charnel house, where so many human remains, and so many crimes have rotted in company, many great ones of this world, many innocent people, have contributed their bones, from Enguerrand de Marigny, the first victim, and a just man, to Admiral de Coligny, who was its last, and who was also a just man. As for the mysterious disappearance of Quasimodo, this is all that we have been able to discover. About 18 months or 2 years after the events which terminate this story, when search was made in that cavern for the body of Olivier La Dame, who had been hanged 2 days previously, and to whom Charles Ville had granted the favor of being buried in St. Laurent, in better company, they found among all those hideous carcasses two skeletons, one of which held the other in its embrace. One of these skeletons, which was that of a woman, still had a few strips of a garment which had once been white, and around her neck was to be seen a string of a dresserich beads with a little silk bag ornamented with green glass, which was open and empty. These objects were of so little value that the executioner had probably not cared for them. The other, which held this one in a close embrace, was the skeleton of a man. It was noticed that his spinal column was crooked, his head seated on his shoulder blades, and that one leg was shorter than the other. Moreover, there was no fracture of the vertebrae at the nape of the neck, and it was evident that he had not been hanged. Hence, the man to whom it had belonged had come thither, and had died there. When they tried to detach the skeleton which he held in his embrace, he fell to dust. Note added to the definitive edition. It is by mistake that this edition was announced as augmented by many new chapters. The work should have been unpublished. In fact, if by new, newly made is to be understood, the chapters added to this edition are not new. They were written at the same time as the rest of the work. They date from the same epoch, and sprang from the same thought. They have always formed a part of the manuscript of Notre Dame de Paris. Moreover, the author cannot comprehend how fresh developments could be added to a work of this character after its completion. This is not to be done at will. According to his idea, a romance is born in a manner that is, in some sort, necessary, with all its chapters. A drama is born with all its scenes. Think not that there is anything arbitrary in the numbers of parts of which that whole, that mysterious microcosm which you call a drama or a romance, is composed. Grafting and soldering take badly on works of this nature, which should gush forth in a single stream and so remain. The thing once done, do not change your mind, do not touch it up. The book once published, the sex of the work, whether virile or not, has been recognized and proclaimed. When the child has once uttered his first cry, he is born, there he is made so, neither father nor mother can do anything, he belongs to the air, and to the sun, let him live or die, such as he is. Has your book been a failure? So much the worse. Add no chapters to an unsuccessful book. Is it incomplete? You should have completed it when you conceived it. Is your tree crooked? You cannot straighten it up. Is your romance consumptive? Is your romance not capable of living? You cannot supply it with the breath which it lacks. Has your drama been born lame? Take my advice, and do not provide it with a wooden leg. Hence the author attaches particular importance to the public knowing for a certainty that the chapters here added have not been made expressly for this reprint. They were not published in the preceding editions of the book for a very simple reason. At the time when Notre Dame de Paris was printed the first time, the manuscript of these three chapters had been mislaid. It was necessary to rewrite them, or to dispense with them. The author considered that the only two of these chapters which were in the least important, owing to their extent, were chapters on art and history which in no way interfered with the groundwork of the drama and the romance, that the public would not notice their loss, and that he, the author, would alone be in possession of the secret. He decided to omit them, and then, if the whole truth must be confessed, his indolence shrunk from the task of rewriting the three lost chapters. He would have found it a shorter matter to make a new romance. Now the chapters have been found, and he avails himself of the first opportunity to restore them to their place. This now is his entire work, such as he dreamed it, such as he made it, good or bad, durable or fragile, but such as he wishes it. These recovered chapters will possess no doubt, but little value in the eyes of persons, otherwise very judicious, who have sought in Notre Dame de Paris only the drama, the romance. But there are perchance, other readers, who have not found it useless to study the aesthetic and philosophic thought concealed in this book, and who have taken pleasure, while reading Notre Dame de Paris, in unraveling beneath the romance something else than the romance, and in following, may we be pardoned these rather ambitious expressions, the system of the historian and the aim of the artist through the creation of the poet. For such people especially, the chapters added to this edition will complete Notre Dame de Paris, if we admit that Notre Dame de Paris was worth the trouble of completing. In one of these chapters on the present decadence of architecture, and on the death, in his mind almost inevitable, of that king of arts, the author expresses and develops an opinion unfortunately well rooted in him, and well thought out. But he feels it necessary to say here that he earnestly desires that the future may, someday, put him in the wrong. He knows that art in all its forms has everything to hope from the new generations whose genius, still in the germ, can be heard gushing forth in our studios. The grain is in the furrow, the harvest will certainly be fine. He merely fears, and the reason may be seen in the second volume of this edition, that the sap may have been withdrawn from that ancient soil of architecture which has been for so many centuries the best field for art. Nevertheless, there are today in the artistic youth so much life, power, and, so to speak, predestination, that in our schools of architecture in particular, at the present time, the professors, who are detestable, produce, not only unconsciously but even in spite of themselves, excellent pupils, quite the reverse of that potter mentioned by Horace, who dreamed amphorae and produced pots. Tilde cur rota, ursin exit tilde. But, in any case, whatever may be the future of architecture, in whatever manner our young architects may one day solve the question of their art, let us, while waiting for new monument, preserve the ancient monuments. Let us, if possible, inspire the nation with a love for national architecture. That, the author declares, is one of the principal aims of this book. It is one of the principal aims of his life. Notre Dame de Paris has, perhaps, opened some true perspectives on the art of the Middle Ages, on that marvelous art which up to the present time has been unknown to some, and, what is worse, misknown by others. But the author is far from regarding as accomplished the task which he has voluntarily imposed on himself. He has already pleaded on more than one occasion the cause of our ancient architecture. He has already loudly denounced many profanations, many demolitions, many impieties. He will not grow weary. He has promised himself to recur frequently to this subject. He will return to it. He will be as indefatigable in defending our historical edifices as our iconoclasts of the schools and academies are eager in attacking them. For it is a grievous thing to see into what hands the architecture of the Middle Ages has fallen, and in what a manner the botchers of plaster of the present day treat the ruin of this grand art. It is even a shame for us intelligent men who see them at work, and content ourselves with hooting them. And we are not speaking here merely of what goes on in the provinces, but of what is done in Paris at our very doors, beneath our windows, in the great city, in the lettered city, in the city of the press, of word, of thought. We cannot resist the impulse to point out, in concluding this note, some of the acts of vandalism which are every day planned, debated, begun, continued, and successfully completed under the eyes of the artistic public of Paris, face to face with criticism, which is disconcerted by so much audacity. An archbishop's palace has just been demolished, an edifice in poor taste, no great harm is done. But in a block with the archiepiscopal palace, a bishop's palace has been demolished, a rare fragment of the 14th century, which the demolishing architect could not distinguish from the rest. He has torn up the wheat with the tares, 'tis all the same. They are talking of raising the admirable chapel of Vincennes, in order to make, with its stones, some fortification, which Domesnil did not need, however. While the Palace Bourbon, that wretched edifice, is being repaired at great expense, gusts of wind and equinoctial storms are allowed to destroy the magnificent painted windows of the Sainte-Chapelle. For the last few days there has been a scaffolding on the tower of Saint-Jacques de la Boucherie, and one of these mornings the pick will be laid to it. A mason has been found to build a little white house between the venerable towers of the Palace de Justice. Another has been found willing to prune away Saint-Germain-des-Prés, the feudal abbey with three bell towers. Another will be found, no doubt, capable of pulling down Saint-Germain-l'Auxerrois. All these masons claim to be architects, are paid by the prefecture, or from the petty budget, and wear green coats. All the harm which false taste can inflict on good taste, they accomplish. While we write, deplorable spectacle, one of them holds possession of the Tuileries, one of them is giving Philibert Delormescar across the middle of his face. And it is not, assuredly, one of the least of the scandals of our time, to see with what effrontery the heavy architecture of this gentleman is being flattened over one of the most delicate facades of the Renaissance. Paris, October 20, 1832. End of the Project Gutenberg et ex Notre Dame de Paris, by Victor Hugo.